In this episode, I talk with Eric Rawson. Eric's an exercise physiologist who studies healthy human aging. In this episode, we dig into the concept of exercise snacks and how short, frequent bouts of movement dispersed throughout the day can lead to big changes and improvements in health. We also talk about the misconception when it comes to resistance exercise, where people think that you need a large dose to elicit an effective response, which is not the case. We also dig into creatine. We talk about its applications. We also talk about potential side effects. And toward the very end, as I was about to thank him for coming on the podcast, we lost power. So there's an abrupt end in the parade of storms, the West Coast weather phenomenon that's apparently once in multiple decades was going on at the time. We lost power for a minute. It knocked out the internet. And we lost Eric, but we did get everything that we wanted to get into the episode. So you're not missing anything other than me thanking him. I was extremely grateful that he gave some of his time to the podcast. And so without further ado, please enjoy my interview with Eric Rawson. All right. Today I'm talking to Eric. Eric, I'm happy to have you here. It's Eric Rawson. He is a PhD researcher. He's a doctor, but the good kind, because he researches hypertrophy and strength and how it relates to healthy aging and other topics that I'm super interested in. Now, this is a field that I believe is understudied. There's a couple guys and girls out there that are researching this, trying to elucidate the benefits. But again, like I said, I think it's super understudied. So I'm really happy to have you here. So yeah, welcome to the podcast, man.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm thrilled with the invitation, and I'm quite happy to finally meet you outside of the wonderful world of Twitter.
Yeah, likewise. It seems like, you know, for a long time there was this, the gym bros, right? The mm-hmm. that are into strength training and hypertrophy type goals, and people commonly associated that with like it's vanity. It's I want to look good, you know, or whatever. But I think we're starting to find out more and more that's not necessarily the case, that there are health implications to having muscle mass, building strength. So I just wanted to highlight that I think the work that you're doing is important. And that's why I think it's understudied, is because we don't appreciate, at least it may be my bias, but we don't appreciate the role that this can play. And I think some of it's because the negative connotation from the bodybuilding clique and the Instagram weightlifting crowd and that type of thing. So hopefully we can dispel some rumors and educate people. Now,
love to.
Because it's such an understudied area, I'm really interested in what brought you to where you are. Like, how did you get from, you know, high school, you had to mm-hmm. choose a career path and that arc happened. So what brought you around to where you are today?
That's a great question. And we'd have to go back to even before high school to figure this out. And I think we'd have to go all the way back to when I was a young child, and the men in my family were prolific readers. They read everything, lots of science fiction, classic books, and I really couldn't stop moving. I was perpetual motion. I was constantly physically active. I would ride my bike 8 or 10 hours per day, skateboard 8 hours on the next day. You know, throw a baseball up and down in the yard for 10 hours. And the only reading I really did was comic books and things about sports. And, you know, in hindsight, what I figured out was that I have this incredible interest in human performance. I just find, you know, making people bigger, faster, and stronger to be an incredibly exciting thing. And even as a young child, I very, very much remember always trying to exceed my previous record in something, right? And it could have been how long I could hold my breath. It could have been how long I could ride a wheelie on my bike. But it was always a performance improvement. And in addition to, you know, the physical aspect of that, I was always interested in what I could possibly put in my body, meaning food and nutrients, that would help me to achieve my best possible performance. And over the years, I've had the great opportunity to meet different athletes from a whole variety of sports. And a lot of them had that same childhood experience, you know, they were interested in making themselves bigger, faster, stronger, and achieving their best in, you know, just across the board. The comic books were interesting to me because, you know, these superheroes, you know, they embodied these, you know, fictional characters. I was a huge fan of the Incredible Hulk, a bit of a fan of the Flash, mostly the Hulk, and a few other superheroes. And at one point in time, they started running in the backs of the comic books advertisements for training programs, right? In particular, mm-hmm. Charles Atlas's dynamic tension programs. And it led me to the world of bodybuilding and powerlifting and Olympic lifting. And I discovered that, you know, to my eye, you could actually become this type of superhero.
Right.
So, my interests since the very beginning have been anatomy, physiology, nutrition, and human performance. It was just always there.
Oh, that's interesting.
So back in the 80s, when I was finishing up high school, seemed like all of my friends were headed off to college. They were studying engineering. They were studying computer science. And I was the only person interested in studying the human body. And I had no idea how to turn that into a career or what the profession would be. I just knew I wanted more anatomy and physiology. I didn't know there was a nutrition profession. I didn't know there was a course called exercise physiology. And I started out in physical therapy, and I learned that there's a rehabilitation side of the fence and there's a prevention side of the fence. There's a huge amount of overlap, particularly with Americans today in terms of their health. But I really didn't belong in rehabilitation. And I was in physical therapy. That was the wrong place for me, and discovered exercise science accidentally. And, I thought I would be the world's greatest personal trainer. I thought I would own at least one gym. And eventually I encountered a woman named Priscilla Clarkson, who taught me about how to be excellent as an educator, as a mentor. And she taught me about research and how, you know, someone like me could contribute to research, to generating new knowledge. So it's always been the same thing. How do I make people bigger, faster, and stronger? Except, you know, I started out with applying this to myself. Now I'm applying it to other people. And in particular, I've grown an interest in applying that type of thinking to older adults. So any type of exercise, any type of nutritional intervention that promotes human health, and in particular, I've always been fascinated with skeletal muscle much more than the cardiovascular system.
Yeah, it's cooler. I mean, come on.
Well, I've always said anything that lasts longer than 30 seconds, I'm just not going to do it.
Well, the reason I think this is great is because, you know, I'm sure the listeners are aware we have a rapidly aging population. The baby boomers are getting older. I read a statistic that 10,000 baby boomers retire every day, and almost exactly 10,000 baby boomers almost also die every day. And so, you know, it's sad in a sense because we are increasingly the unhealthiest generations that our species has ever produced.
Sure. And
it's long and storied history, you know?
Yes, I've come around at a very interesting time where when I started all of this, and this is a long part of the discussion, but when I started all of this, we weren't talking about obesity and we weren't talking about diabetes, not as researchers, not as gym bros, not as parents. There just wasn't the emphasis. And throughout the 90s, from children all the way up to adults and older adults, the increase of lifestyle diseases has been shocking. The increase in obesity has been shocking. The increase in physical inactivity has been shocking. And, you know, coming from someone who loves movement, it's been, you know, incredible to watch how fast these changes happened. And of course, this changed research funding, it changed research interests. But for me at this point, I think successful aging is probably the most important thing we could be studying.
Yeah. And one of the things that I find particularly interesting when it comes to aging is that when we look at the poor metabolic health, you look at insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, it in many respects at a cellular level mirrors accelerated aging. So when you're doing research into the one, you are kind of by default also doing research into the other. And so I definitely think that what you're doing has a direct application to even someone who is aging healthily, right, has a benefit right to them. But this also has a benefit and application to those that are younger who are experiencing accelerated aging, even though they may not see it as that because of the insulin resistance, the diabetes. I mean, insulin resistance, it begins inside the muscle, right? So, and that's an area where we often talk about how diet is fundamental to fat loss and that people need to fix their diets first. And absolutely, when you look at the proliferation of ultra processed food and how our diets gotten so far off track, I think that's fair. But because insulin resistance and these things begin inside the muscle before you can even see them on, you know, on regular blood work, what or how strong of a protective role do you think physical activity plays in preventing these types of you know, diseases, the insulin resistance, the type 2 diabetes, outside of diet? So I know that exercise improves insulin resistance or insulin sensitivity rather, independent of diet. But how strong do you think that signal is? Like, what do you think? I guess what I'm getting at is, provided the same terrible food environment, provided the same environment that we're in, take the physically active kid versus the inactive kid, or the person who's exercising versus not, and strip away weight loss. Like, how important is that exercise? What do you think that's doing on a cellular level to help prevent the poor metabolic health that we're seeing?
That's a great question. The short answer to me is it's a robust signal, and it's incredibly important to maintain a level of cardiorespiratory fitness, of muscular fitness, and of habitual physical activity levels, even if you're struggling to maintain a healthy body weight. I think the signal, the benefit of being physically active is absolutely protective against disease. And I think where the conversation has to go is, well, a few places. One is, you know, how are we defining health, right? Because your question was about cardiometabolic disease or metabolic disease. And, you know, there are other types of diseases. We're interested in cardiometabolic disease. We're interested in mental health. We're interested in cancer. And so the one part of the question is, where does physical activity fit in terms of creating a signal to reduce our risk of disease? And then the other half of the question is, should it be aerobic endurance training, or should it be resistance training, or should it be both? And that's something I've been very vocal about, and you've been vocal about in the past few years. That is, we're underselling the benefits of resistance training in terms of protecting our health.
Right. Good.
And I think you mentioned something else, and that's relates to age. This is not just a discussion that starts when you're over the age of 75 or 65 or 45. You know, young people today have much lower levels of muscle strength. They have many more distractions to prevent them from being physically active. It's very much a toxic environment in terms of being physically fit and physically active. So this is a lifespan discussion, and we're talking about maybe successful aging, but we should start the discussion with children, really.
Yeah, I think for most people, they don't actually think about aging and its impact on them until they start to get to maybe that midpoint, 40 years old, or, you know, they start feeling some physiological changes.
Until they get sick.
Yeah.
Or even sick.
Well, you know, that coincidentally, I mean, I went into the Marine Corps right out of high school, and I wasn't a very fit. I mean, I wasn't lazy. I lived on a dairy farm, but I wasn't an athlete, I should say. And so I went into the Marine Corps, and that was my first like hard structured physical training. And I think what helped me was, you know, we had to be physically active at your morning PT 5 days a week. It wasn't like you had a choice. And I've learned later as a little older as an adult that we are the product of our habits. And because people grow up where we're in an environment that's not forcing physical activity anymore, we simply don't do it. So we never build a habit to do it. And then we transition as we get older and older, those things start to take their toll on us. And to your point, there's already damage being done that entire time of inactivity. Yes. Where I got lucky was, I think going into the military, I was forced to build this habit that I just carried on after I left the military. So even when I got fat, at one point I was obese, I was 50 something pounds overweight. I'm not the tallest guy in the world. I'm 5'9". It's a tall 5'9", but it's 5'9" nonetheless. And so gaining 50 pounds of not muscle was significant, but I kept exercising through all that. And so I've always felt that the physical activity that I've engaged in, because my blood work was still good during that time, even though my doctor was concerned with the weight gain. Yes. So I do think that being physically active, in my own experience and based on the literature as well, it's definitely, I think, protective. But to me, it just comes back to the modern environment from technology impacting food preservation and the availability of these terrible ultra processed foods and ubiquitous of food in general everywhere, screens, remote controls for TVs, everything's automated now. There's Uber Eats. Right. They bring you your food. Like we don't have to do much to exist. Mm-hmm. And throughout the rest of human history, just to exist and not die, you had to be physically active, which is why modern hunter-gatherer societies are very interesting to me, not because I think we should do everything they do, but because they have to exert high levels of physical activity just to exist. And then when we look at their metabolic health, it's quite high. There's no obesity, they're not overweight. And, you know, everybody focuses on diet, and I do think diet's very important, but it almost seems mm-hmm. like I get engaged in these debates where people are talking hunter-gatherers, and it's almost all like 90% of it's diet. You know, or you look at the blue zones and it's everything, everybody focuses on diet. And I'm looking at the blue zones and I'm like, these people don't drive cars, they walk everywhere, they live in the hills. Like they go to bed on time. They don't have screens. Like they have strong family ties. And there's all these other factors. And I think because our diet's so terrible here in America and in some of the West, that we harp on that. But I almost feel like we're just forgetting everything else, and we just shoot straight to diet. Like that's everything. And I even see it on, especially on Twitter, you got tons of people and they really struggle to exercise and they like endlessly manipulate and tinker with their diet and adjust all these little things, and all the while still are not physically active enough. So I don't want to, I guess I'm on soapbox for a second here, just because I feel like we really do hammer diet justifiably, like I said, because of how things are in the West. But I think we need to also step back and realize that the other side of that coin is getting people physically active, getting them to, like we talked about, resistance train. If they love doing cardio, by all means, go do cardio. I do it myself. I'm not an anti-cardio guy. But actually, on that same token, resistance training is cardio. So one of the things I hate is this, when we refer to exercise and it's like, okay, you got strength training and then you've got your cardio. And I'm like, last time I checked, my heart rate was up pretty well during my strength training. So maybe you can elucidate the listener to how strength training is cardio. And especially, I think if you're sedentary and you're coming off the couch, it's great cardio, like just getting physically active. And so if you can just kind of dig in that a little bit, that'd be awesome.
Absolutely. And if you have some room up on your soapbox, I'll come right up there with you. It's wonderful that we talk so much about nutrition, but we talk about nutrition at the expense of physical activity. I happen to live in central Pennsylvania, and I am surrounded by the Amish population. And I have to tell you that their diet could not be described as vegan or low fat or any popular diet. They're not ketogenic. They're not carnivore. If anything, they probably consume more butter and more salt and more gravy than is typically recommended. But their rates of obesity are incredibly low. And I would connect that to their muscle strength, which is incredibly high, and their daily physical activity. They get 3 or 4 times the steps that a typical American does. You know, they're physically active, and See, I believe physical activity modifies our dietary behaviors. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons that they can eat three meals per day and not snack is one, because that's the habit they built. But two, it's easier to do that because their body is regulated in terms of energy intake by their high energy output. I think physical activity very much regulates our energy intake, our calorie intake. And there are data from, gosh, 6 decades ago, showing that in very active populations, it's quite easy to achieve energy balance. And this was before apps, and no one did diet records back then, right? So people who burned the most calories ate the most calories, but they only ate enough to maintain their body weight. People who burned the fewest calories mismatched their energy intake and overate. So we really can't talk about nutrition, whether it's carbs, fats, or protein, or calories. We really can't talk about nutrition without that direct connection to physical activity, because I'm quite sure our physical activity levels help modulate our dietary behaviors. So I'm up on the soapbox with you. I love that we talk about nutrition so much, but not at the expense of physical activity and physical fitness.
Yeah, and it makes sense, because from an evolutionary standpoint, like there's never been, except for maybe a few in the aristocracy in most recent 4,000 years or so, but there is no physically inactive human. It couldn't have existed before, right? It would have resulted in you expiring. I mean, you would have been selected, you're gone, you know? So
exactly.
To me, I feel like it's one of the arguments that I have sometimes on social media is like, I don't ever want to shame anyone who's sedentary. I don't want anybody to feel like I'm putting them down for not being physically active, especially because historically we would have simply had to be physically active to survive. We weren't choosing it. It was just what you had to do. Now, because we're no longer in that environment, we have to choose it. So I want to be careful to make sure people know I'm encouraging people to be physically active, but I'm not trying to shame anyone. I don't think that's the right approach. But yeah, to your point, people often look at my blood work's great or my labs are great and I lost weight, which is awesome. All that stuff's awesome. But to me, if you're not physically active, I don't care how good a health you think you're in, like you're not in that good health. If you can look at the data, even when they control for obesity and waist circumference and everything else, if you're sedentary, it's literally like smoking. The correlation to mortality increases like smoking, even after controls. Right. So, you know, to me, it's like, it's a false sense of security to think that you're physically inactive, yet you're actually healthy. You may be free of disease, or at least observable disease, but that's a different thing than being robustly healthy to me.
Right. I agree. And our own personal experience is valuable, but it's a snapshot. It's a single time point type of, you know, sample size of one study. I can tell you, you know, what I'm doing right now in terms of nutrition and exercise and my blood work. But that doesn't mean that this will be the successful plan 10 years from now or 15 years from now. And I think that's part of what people are missing is we're talking about, years of health. We're talking about successful aging. And not just being able maybe to get away with being less active because you're only in your 20s or your 30s or you're in your early 40s. Things will start to accelerate after about the age of 40 or 45 in terms of declines in fitness and declines in muscular strength. And that will make it harder to develop the physical activity habit again. I want to touch on something you said about resistance training being aerobic or cardiorespiratory training. This is actually a question that I include in one of my exercise physiology labs every year. When we do laboratories for, you know, musculoskeletal strength, we tend to separate those from the laboratories on cardiorespiratory fitness. But I like the students to realize there's so much important overlap there. We tend to teach the components of fitness separately, and we tend to teach the metabolic systems separately. That's how we have to teach it, but there is a lot of overlap there. So one of the questions I always pose to the students is, it's quite simple. It's, you know, does resistance training increase your VO2 max or your maximal cardiorespiratory fitness? And so many of them are shocked to stumble upon that research to show that in particular, if your fitness is low, you will have an increase in VO2 max and maximal cardiorespiratory fitness from a very modest resistance exercise program. Now, that's improvement. That's important for a few obvious reasons. One is that it works, right? Resistance training can increase your cardiorespiratory fitness. Two, cardiorespiratory fitness is an incredibly good predictor of mortality, right? So if we're increasing VO2 max, then we're having beneficial effects on mortality. But I think, you know, the real benefit here is that it reaches people who maybe will not do aerobic type exercise training, or they cannot do it, or they don't enjoy it, or they find it painful. You know, a lot of, for a lot of frail elders, getting on a treadmill is a very scary experience. For a lot of large people who have arthritis and pain, doing cardiovascular exercise is nightmarish. It's you're offering them punishment to improve their health. Right. And I think a lot of these people could really benefit more if the starting point was resistance exercise.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And even with my own clients, which I mean, I do have a knowledge of cardiorespiratory geared exercise. I mean, I mm-hmm. can coach that. It's not what I don't take people on for that purpose, because there are people way more qualified than me. If you want to go run a marathon or something, that's not, you know, mm-hmm. that's not my jam. But I find that when people start out and you focus on resistance exercise, and I tend to take people that are novice, and we reduce their rest period. So we keep the sessions brief. We keep the intensity yes. up. We keep the pace up. What happens is they do improve, like you're talking about, their conditioning improves, all their overall fitness levels increase. Mm-hmm. And a perfect example is I have one client that we've been working together for maybe like 9 months now. And at first it was just resistance exercise. And then she started and walking. I encourage people to walk. I mean, walking mm-hmm. is incredible for us for tons of different reasons. We can dive into those. But anyway, she started out walking. And then from walking, it was, well, I feel like jogging now. Like, she lost weight. She built up quite a bit of muscle mass. She had a stronger yeah. musculoskeletal system. And then I actually feel comfortable saying, have at it. If you feel like it, go run, man. That's great. Right. Like when people are yes. weak, you know, when their musculoskeletal system overall is weak, and then you take it and you place this demand of repetitive, you know, whether it's running or whatever the case is, you're going to make adaptations and you're going to get stronger even in response to that. But I feel like strengthening the musculoskeletal system through resistance training first, and then adding in the additional mm-hmm. cardiovascular training, I find that works well for a lot of people, especially when they're coming off the couch.
Yes. We would never discourage people from doing aerobic exercise training. I strongly encourage everyone to increase the amount of walking they do. But, you know, if you look at the data on, you know, how physically inactive we are, you realize that we're not getting people to exercise. And never saying, you know, don't walk, don't do the treadmill, never saying don't do the Stairmaster. But really, you know, looking at people as individuals and saying, what can I do to help this person develop an exercise habit? And like I said, for a person who's frail and they're concerned about a fall, maybe the treadmill is more anxiety than benefit.
Sure.
Right. And for a large person, you know, even the seat on an exercise bike could be painful. And if they have arthritis, then walking isn't what to start with. And I've always believed that if all you can do is sit in a chair and I can hand you some dumbbells, and you can do presses and you can do curls and you can do a variety of different exercises. In my own experience in working with people, they feel better and they make progress quickly, progress that they can see by number of repetitions, by the weight they're lifting. And it's really hard to see that progress on cardiovascular type exercises when your fitness is very low or when you're very, very large. So I've always thought that, you know, getting people engaged in resistance exercise is a great starting point that will spontaneously lead to more physical activity, more walking briskly, and potentially even jogging, things like team activities, things like pickleball. I think the foundation is muscular strength.
Yeah.
And I often ask people, I say, when you go to the airport, what do you see at the escalators? And they say, huge line of people waiting at the escalators. And I say, what do you see at the stairs? And they say, the stairs are empty. And I say, okay, is no one in a hurry? Everyone is, you know, on time and has plenty of time. Why are they waiting for the escalator when the stairs are open and they could just cut the line? And, you know, if you're in an airport, you're surrounded by thousands of people. Don't you want some space? Why is everyone all crowded around the escalator and waiting? And I take the stairs. You know, I take the stairs on purpose because I've been sitting on an airplane, right? And I want to use my muscles. I want to use my body. But I think one of the reasons that my brain will tell me to take the stairs is that the stairs are no more difficult for me than the escalator. And that's not because of my cardio. I think that's from years of squatting.
Right.
Right. I think my muscular strength, even with my luggage, gets me up the stairs, and it's just as effortless as standing on the escalator. Whereas in my opinion, and it's only my opinion, I think most people, their muscular fitness is so poor, combined with maybe heavier body weights, that the escalator is really a lot easier for them than the stairs. The stairs will be a difficult challenge for them, so they don't take it. And I look at that and I think, that's an opportunity for a resistance exercise intervention to help these people. I think the activities that I choose to do are based on my muscular strength, not my cardio.
Yeah, I think in day-to-day life, my experience is similar. So like we moved from a one-story to a two-story recently, specifically because we had to move anyways. And my youngest had always wanted to live in a two-story house. He's 8 now. Well, he'll be 8 shortly. And then my daughter, she's 16. And when she was younger, she always wanted to live in a two-story house. So we thought, hey, let's do it, you know? So we move in and my wife hates the stairs. She's like, oh my God, why did we do this? but the funny thing is what I do. So our stairs are like halfway up. Then you turn, you flip a U-turn the rest of the way up. So it's like a two-piece staircase. Right. So at the bottom, almost every time, I'd say 95% of the times I've gone up that staircase, I literally take 2 to 3 stairs at a time and I run up it as fast as I can. Like I make the turn as quick as I can and I like fly up it, you know, it almost like I'm doing step ups, and it's not hard at all for me, but it's like, right, on the one hand, it's kind of fun, you know, but also I've come to realize earlier on in, you know, just my fitness journey or whatever you want to refer to it as, I had the training bout. So you're going to go to the gym or you're going to train at home, whatever it is, but you've got your structured exercise session. And I used to think, okay, well, I'm working on the computer, I'm sitting a lot, but I'm working out, so I'm good, right? It counteracts the physical inactivity. And recently, a lot of data are coming out that suggests that, hey, being active for 30, 45 minutes a day is great, but it's not undoing that 9 to 10 hours of sitting around.
Yes.
You need to break up that sitting around and have physical activity for circulation of lymphatic fluid and blood and everything else, you know, getting your muscles moving. So when I do have to go upstairs for something and I'm home, I take that little sprinting up the stairs as like a way to help break up my periods of inactivity. And similarly, when we go to malls or anywhere else where there's stairs, I'm like you, I'll take the stairs. But I think part of that's because mentally I understand the benefit and I think, oh, that's good for me. I'm going to go ahead and do that. And I think a lot of people, they don't, like we hinted on earlier, I think resistance exercise being such a boon for health is underappreciated. And so since people don't realize that, I think if more people understood it, more people would actually go through the trouble to do it. They just don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think resistance training, the research is lagged behind aerobic exercise training. But I do think a lot of people know that moving is better than sitting. I think they know that the stairs are better for them than the escalator or the elevator. Perhaps they Perhaps they don't know that, you know, one sprint up the stairs can have real health benefits. I would imagine most people don't know that. And we call that in research exercise snacks. So there's some wonderful research where they have people, you know, go for a 5-minute walk every hour on the hour, or, you know, climb a flight of stairs, you know, a few times per day. And there were real cardiometabolic benefits, measurable cardiometabolic benefits, which, given how variable the response is to exercise, to how we all improve differently, that's phenomenal, that just a tiny bit of exercise throughout the day can have real measurable benefits. What we're fighting against, you know, how automated our lifestyles have become. And, you know, I'm at a standing desk right now. I have a standing desk at the office. And that will burn probably an extra 9 calories per hour, which is better than zero. But I could, you know, easily overwhelm that with, you know, just one bad dietary choice or one slip. So we're trying to overcome a very toxic environment. And I think, you know, developing exercise habits, we have to be very smart. It's much more nuanced than everybody go jogging, right? That we know that's not going to be effective. One thing I'll share with you, and I guess I'm not sure how old your followers are, but if they're around my age, they've lived through an interesting time when it comes to exercise, in particular resistance training. So when I started all of this, it wasn't okay for old people to lift weights, right? It was unsafe.
That's crazy.
And it wasn't okay for children to lift weights because it was unsafe and dangerous. Now, both of those things have no evidence. They had no evidence then. They have no evidence now. This is all silly. And when I started all of this, athletes did not lift weights, with the exception of maybe some linemen in American football and shot putters, throwers in track and field. If you were a gymnast and you got caught lifting weights, you'd probably get thrown out of the weight room and threatened with the loss of your scholarship. Golfers didn't lift weights. Women, of course, didn't lift weights, right? So I've lived through all of this, you know, ridiculousness. None of it was evidence-based, but I've watched the research kind of catch up. And that goes for women. It goes for older adults. It goes for children. It, you know, it goes for obese adults, people with, you know, stable medical diseases. It goes for athletes. You know, think of the whole field of strength and conditioning not existing. That wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, you're right. It's pretty crazy if you think of, I mean, Tiger Woods. Right? I remember when Tiger Woods was young and he was a rookie, mm-hmm. and people were literally like, why is he lifting weights? Like, that's, he's a golfer. Like, what's he in the weight room for? Or the Williams sisters playing tennis. And people were like shocked that they're like weight training hard like that. And then you're like, oh, granted, it's skill. I'm not saying she's the most dominant female tennis player ever because she's jacked. But my point is the power that she has and the strong musculoskeletal system that she developed certainly improved her sport. She was able to use her strength to her advantage. So now you see it in every sport. Even the, I think it was last to break into the high socioeconomic status sports for whatever reason, or at least it seems that way. And it also seems that when it comes to endurance, endurance training almost universally, I've noticed like attorneys and doctors and your a lot of researchers, they gravitate, I would say people with a higher education level, higher socioeconomic status, they kind of gravitate to endurance training. And only recently, and I know most runners now I see, they're starting to strength train 2 days a week. They're doing these things. So they've learned and they're accepting that. But it seems like for whatever reason, there was a long-term disconnect where it was your blue collar guys are in the gym slinging weight. And then your white collar guys are riding bikes and running marathons. And it's like, we're finally seeing an amalgamation of these things coming together, you know?
Yes, it's evolved, right? So I, at the beginning of my career, you know, the only people who were supposed to be lifting weights were, you know, linemen in football, shot putters, and weightlifters, and everyone else was supposed to avoid it. Again, no evidence behind, you know, the ridiculous concept of getting muscle bound. And we got through that, and people would talk about loss of flexibility, no evidence behind that. And we talk about increased risk of injury, which no evidence behind that, right? So today, if you think of LeBron James without lifting weights, if you think of Tiger Woods, if you think of Serena Williams, if you think of any athlete in any sport not lifting weights, that almost seems like negligence on the part of the athletic trainers and the coaches, because, you know, in addition to the strength, in addition to the power, we have a reduction in injuries. We have protection from injuries. And we've gotten to a place now where when we teach you about the benefits of resistance training, we've gotten through the myths, right? We've gotten through the muscle bound stuff and the injuries and all the things that were never really true. But we tend to teach the benefits of resistance training in a very, very limited capacity. We talk about increased strength. We talk about increased power. Once in a while, we get to the part about, you know, protection from injury. We've all signed on to resistance training as part of rehabilitation from injury, right? But we're still not talking about the protective effects of resistance training against cardiometabolic disease. We're not talking about resistance exercise improving quality of life in cancer patients. We're not talking about resistance training, and there's research to support this, you know, resistance training reducing your risk of mortality. No aerobic training at all, just resistance training twice a week, you know, improved mortality. And we're getting better at talking about it. For me, the one thing that no one's talking about, and I've tried to be loud about it, is I think we can use resistance training to modify behavior.
Okay.
I think we live at a time where it's very difficult to develop healthy habits, where it's very difficult to become physically active. And I think there's some evidence that resistance training will improve many other systems in your body, and also potentially spontaneously increase your physical activity. So probably the first and most important resistance training article on resistance training in older adults was from Maria Fiadaroni and colleagues, and it was published in our most prestigious medical journal, and it showed remarkable increases in muscle strength in old people lifting weights. Everyone was shocked that they didn't just die, right? You know, the mean age in the article was over 90 years old. You know, so they weren't old like 55, they were old like 95.
Right.
They lifted weights, they had massive improvements in strength and walking speed. But the part of the article that no one read was the part that shows a really large increase in habitual physical activity. They made frail elders lift weights and they got more active in their free living time. And then a few years later, also from the same group at Tufts University, Miriam Nelson published a 12-month resistance training paper, and it was supposed to be about bone, which we always talk about, right? But in the paper, the part that no one read was that the group who didn't lift weights had a spontaneous reduction in physical activity, and the group who lifted weights for a year, again, only about 2 days per week, minimal, they increased the amount of physical activity they did outside of the gym spontaneously. It wasn't part of the study. And there's been several investigations. They've used all different types of ways to measure physical activity. It's a small body of literature, but it includes overweight people, older adults, middle-aged adults, young adults. And we keep seeing this spontaneous improvement in physical activity outside the gym once we get people stronger.
Yeah, it makes sense. And it kind of aligns with, so one thing I often say on social media is movement begets more movement. And
it's
found
the gateway drug.
Right. And I've found it to be true, like time and time again. There's one guy I follow who started out just walking, right? That was he was super overweight, started walking every day. Next thing you know, he's running triathlons. I mean, obviously there was a journey there, but it began with walking. And then once he was like actually starting to be physically active, he kept becoming more physically active over time. Mm-hmm. To the point where he wanted to challenge his body and gravitated toward triathlons. Some people, you know, they gravitate more and plug into resistance exercise, or whether it's taking your kids camping, whatever. Right. Like, I've seen that experience play out in my own life. I mean, the other day, my kid and I were playing, is it pickleball? It's a, you know, junior tennis in the backyard. Yes. And, he hit it over the, our block wall. And so, and we'd have to go around the neighborhood. I was like, no, I'll just jump over the block wall. I got it. So it's not like I'm that old, but I'm 43 and I'm scaling the block wall and grabbing a thing and jumping back over and totally fine. Well, I mean, I guess theoretically, if I'm super worried about getting injured, yeah, me jumping off a 6-foot wall into my grass is going to increase my injury risk. But I'm confident that my training and my musculoskeletal system are perfectly adequate to handle it. So I still do stuff that most people my age probably wouldn't do. They would just walk around and go get it. But I'm not, you know what I mean? Like that stuff just comes second nature. Like I still do everything I did when I was 20, but I'm 43. Yes. I just do it, like run up the stairs. I do like all that same stuff. My first apartment was a second story apartment when I was 21. And I used to come home from work and I would run up the stairs every time. And I still do that. So that's my experience mirrors exactly what you're saying with clients who start off with a simple 2-day-a-week strength training program. And then it grows from there to running and whatever else they want to do. But yeah, even myself, I see the same things. And as I'm getting older, my daughter's friends, as she's 17, like my daughter's friends' parents and other people, I start seeing the chasm between the stuff I normally do and the stuff they normally do just keeps widening. And I think it goes right back to what you're saying. It's just the fact that I keep moving keeps me moving. I don't consciously force it. It's not hard for me. Like it's not hard for me to do.
Right. I think your brain knows that's not a big deal. Carry your groceries, walk up 2 flights of stairs, walk up 2 stairs at a time, jump over the fence or the wall in the yard. I think your brain does a great job telling you what your limitations are. You know, it's really a cycle that we get trapped in, and no one knows exactly where it starts, but we gain weight, exercise becomes uncomfortable, so we do less of it. And when I say exercise, I mean, you know, purposeful exercise and also physical activity of our daily lives. We do less of it. We move less. We get in that chair quicker. And you know, we think about walking, you know, to a store or, you know, parking far away. We think about it less and less as we become heavier and we become, you know, more tired, we become more fatigued. So we move less and that feeds into becoming heavier, which makes it less likely to move. And the cycle goes round and round with low energy leading to less physical activity and leading to, you know, a higher body weight. And we're fighting against a very remarkable food supply.
Yeah.
Plentiful food supply and food that has been engineered to taste much, much better than the food did, you know, 50 years ago. So it's created to overeat. It's not created to satisfy. And it's tough to break through that with physical activity. I think very few people will be able to just start jogging and start running triathlons and get control of all of this. I think it has to be nuanced and we have to ask ourselves some questions, you know. You know, if the only thing you had, you know, at your, you know, if the only option was running, would you run or do nothing?
Yeah.
Right. A lot of people would say, I won't run. I'll do nothing.
Right.
Okay. Well, what do we do with them? Let's find some resistance exercises for them. Let's start them on the pathway, but with a different starting point. And for some people, I think that's really the way. I think they can feel their strength increase. I think they can see it, you know, around the house, whether it's dragging out the trash barrel or reaching for something on a shelf or opening a jar. I think people can see the improvements in strength with their own two eyes. You know, their fitness is improving. And I do believe that muscular strength is the foundation and resistance exercise is the gateway drug to get people moving more in the, you know, the 23 hours a day we aren't in the gym.
Yeah. When I first started to grow on social media, which was quite by accident. I never planned for it. I wasn't trying to, but I was on Twitter. I was on Twitter to follow mostly researchers so I could learn to apply things to my own training. And then there was a doctor who had an issue with the wrist, and I posted a quick video showing some wrist strengthening exercises she could do at home using a wall. And she's like, oh, this is great. And she retweeted it and started to grow. Some people asked questions. I started making videos, and the rest is history. But one of the things that I noticed is that we need to remove the barriers to physical activity for people to the best of our ability. And so, especially early on, I stopped going to a commercial gym and lifting weights almost entirely when my son was born, which is 8 years ago now. And I decided I was going to switch to calisthenics as a discipline. And I was getting burned out with weight training. So that's why for me, it was like going through the motions and I was finding that I was having to force myself to do it. And my daughter, being a gymnast, at the time I'd seen male gymnasts, I saw these awesome physiques and I was like, you know what? I can do this. Let me take the principles of hypertrophy and strength training and just look at calisthenics and let's structure it so that I'm still doing the things I know need to be done to make this an effective methodology. And then what I found is that resonated with people because they were like, oh, I can do this in my living room. I'm self-conscious. I don't want to go to the gym, or I'm a single mom, or even not necessarily being single. Hey, I've got three kids. It's really difficult to pack them in the car, take them to the daycare, right, go to the gym. So I think to your point, removing barriers and making people understand that the mental model that we have about, okay, what is resistance training? Well, you picture barbells and deadlifts and, like, yeah, that's one way to do it for sure. Mm-hmm. But your body provides adequate resistance. You don't have to necessarily use weights. So if someone's listening to this and you think, okay, I know I need to resistance exercise. I know I need to include resistance exercise. You guys are saying 2 days a week. Well, what I encourage people is all you need is a floor in your body and you can get, and a chair. I mean, you can utilize a chair. There's different ways you can do it, but you can get phenomenal results with no equipment at all. So I think a lot of people also have that mental disconnect where what they think is required to engage in successful resistance exercise, just like you said with running, people are like, well, if I have to run, I'm not going to do cardio. For a lot of people, it's like, well, if I have to drive to the gym, I'm just not going to strength train then. And so I think it's important for people to realize, like, I still, not so much now, because I think I've gotten people to come around to this, but I still get pushback sometime on social media where they're like, you can't get just as good a results with body weight training as you can with using weights. And my retort to that is, yes, you can incrementally, progressively overload easier when you've got 2.5 pound plates, 1 pound dumbbells and all this stuff. Yes, there are advantages, but your muscles don't have eyes where they go, oh, he's got a barbell, let's grow. Oh, it's a push-up, let's not grow. I mean, so maybe you can back me up or tell me I'm wrong, but you know, when it comes to strength and hypertrophy development, it doesn't matter what implement you use. It really doesn't.
Right. And, you know, one of the things, probably the original thing that attracted me to your Twitter account, I tried to keep Twitter, you know, as close to 99% professional development as possible. So I'm following other scientists, I'm sharing new research, and then I like to keep connected to the fitness community. And I discovered your account and I said, look at this stuff this guy's doing with body weight exercises. And it's real exercise. He's not selling anything except real exercise here and progress. And that's why I started following you. I don't know how many years ago. And the thing about resistance exercise is we've overcomplicated it.
Yeah, 100%.
Right. And we've scared people away. On the one hand, we're telling people just go outside and walk, and people can do that. Many people can, not everybody. But then when we advertise resistance exercise, we show pictures of lat pull downs and squat machines and leg presses. And, you know, that's not the same approach we've taken to trying to get people to move more. So, you know, like you said, you just need a floor and you need gravity. And it might be easier to throw a 2.5 pound plate on the end of your barbell, but just slight changes in position can really overload the muscles. And you made a comment about gymnasts earlier. If you go up to anyone in a gym and show them a picture of a gymnast, Olympic level, college level, probably even, high school level, and say, is this a physique that you admire? Is this a good physique? Everyone will say that's fantastic. Look at the development. Look at the muscular development. And it's not from heavy squats and it's not from heavy bench presses. It's from primarily body weight resistance exercise. and lots of repetitions. So, you know, hypertrophy can come from what you do in the gym. If you have, if you can afford the gym, if you will go to the gym, then go to the gym. But if you can't afford the gym, if you, if it doesn't fit into your lifestyle right now, then there's so much you can do at home to improve your muscular strength and your muscle mass, men and women, and get all the health benefits of resistance exercise with what we used to call calisthenics.
Yeah, that's actually why I called it bodyweight strength training. People look at push-ups and you know, non-weighted dips and all that kind of stuff. They look at it as like – and in more toward the endurance side of resistance. You know, when you're setting up your strength training, you've got pure strength, you've got strength hypertrophy, right? And then you've got your strength endurance. And as you optimize more for one, you can pull a little bit away from the others. Now, this is a point where we lost power and I thought I was unable to recover the rest of the content for this interview. So I published this. After publishing, I was actually able to recover the rest of the interview, so I posted that in part two, which should be available in your podcast feed now.